Pastor Steve, thanks so much for inviting Joe and I to be with you today and to celebrate with you and Sue and your wonderful congregation this momentous achievement of 50 years of service. That's great, my friend. And what a pleasant surprise when I walked in and saw our mutual and great friend, Dr. Sam Goldman, here. Sam has led the Beth Jacob congregation for many years in Carbondale, so it's kind of like a little homecoming for the three of us, too. So. Glad of that. The trip from Jerusalem to Bethany, though not very far, must have been extremely burdensome on this day. The small group of disheveled-looking men walked along, the desert sun beating down upon them, the hot wind swirling the sand and dust about their feet. Perhaps they walked along in small groups, maybe two or three, discussing the events of the day. Maybe they were silent, pondering in their own minds what they had seen and heard, but could not understand. Surely, he wasn't serious when he had told them just before leaving Jerusalem that in a very few days, he would be crucified. Crucified? He could be king. What do you mean, crucified? They arrived at the house of Simon in Bethany, a leper whom Jesus had healed of his leprosy. Simon was a relative of Mary and Martha and Lazarus, all of whom lived in this house. Day was all but done. They were tired, worn out, a knock on the door, greetings from an old friend. The customary formalities of entering a Jewish home finished, they retired to the living room to recline on the couches and relax before the dinner being prepared in Jesus' honor would be served. Maybe local politics or the prospects of a good grape harvest, or perhaps the weather, dominated their conversation. It's doubtful that anything lighthearted could have taken place because just a few days before, the mother of James and John had come to Jesus thinking that he was going to come into his earthly kingdom and ask him to seat her sons on the right and the left, the sons who would have positions of power and authority when Jesus became their king. The other disciples had learned about it, and they had become angry, and the tension was still running high. The conversation continued, and an unusual event began to unfold in front of them. In the midst of all that was going on, in my mind's eye, I see her entering the room very quietly, almost without notice. She wasn't supposed to be there at all. This was a place for men. She should be in the kitchen, helping her sister prepare the meal. But there she was, at the feet of the master, soaking in every word, risking the displeasure of her brother and her sister, breaking the social traditions of Simon's house, but with eyes that shone with love and with a heart of discernment far, far beyond even that of the disciples. She had listened to him on other occasions, had watched as he raised her brother from the dead. But on this day, she had come not just to listen, but for a far greater purpose, which even she did not know or understand. She had come to anoint him for his burial, knowing somehow that the cross stood before him. In a very quiet, almost worshipful manner, She took a small alabaster box filled with an expensive perfume. She broke it and she poured it upon his head and his feet. She took her hair and washed his feet with the perfume. It was the most precious possession which she owned, and she lavishly wasted it upon him. It was worth a year's wages and probably had taken her years to save, and she poured it upon him. A strange silence must have overtaken that room. A silence which gave way to spoken words that clearly defined every relationship of the people in that room to Jesus Christ. No one could believe what was happening. What possessed this impetuous young girl to do such a thing? Judas spoke first. How ridiculous! How wasteful! This perfume could have been sold and money given to the poor. You allow her to do this to you? To waste this expensive perfume when our streets are filled with poor people? Without food? Without clothes? What's wrong with you? In this scenario, Judas represents the world. Judas never knew Christ. His reaction was a reaction of those people in the world who do not know Christ. To the world, anything given to Christ is a waste. Why do you go down to that church on Sunday and waste half your day? Why do you give money to the church? Such a waste. Why do you waste your time trying to witness to someone who doesn't want to listen to you anyway? The world doesn't understand. It cannot understand. But there are those that do understand. Thank God for our fellow Christians. We can surely count on one another. We shouldn't care so much about how the world sees us, sees our giving, our service, but surely our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ will understand, won't they? Listen to Matthew 26:8. When the disciples saw what Mary had done, they were indignant. They rebuked her harshly. What? When the disciples saw what Mary had done, they were indignant. They rebuked her harshly. This was her spiritual family. They didn't understand. They had walked with him for 3 years now, had shared every day, had listened to his words, had seen him calm the sea, heal the blind, raise the dead. And yet they could not understand this kind of love which Mary possessed. A love that just consumes. A love that never stops to count the cost. A love that wastes the most precious possession upon him. Is it possible that sometimes when we see a fellow Christian who is so in love with Christ that they're willing to just pour themselves out upon him, not in some showy, frenzied, fervent display of emotion necessarily, but in a quiet, joyful fashion? Is it possible that we in the spiritual family, the church, look upon them a little indignantly and think in our mind, what a waste? When everyone else deserts us, fails to understand us, the family is always there, the real family, the physical family into which we are born. Martha would understand. Lazarus certainly would understand. Simon would. Martha is so close to Christ. He had healed Simon's leprosy. He raised Lazarus from the dead. They'll understand Mary's love for him. Nowhere, not one place in the gospel, in a family that had been so graciously forgiven, healed, restored to life, do we find one comment in support of Mary's action. In fact, Martha complained vigorously about Mary sitting at his feet, wasting her time just listening, loving him. And do you remember Jesus' comment on that day to Martha? Martha, Martha, you worry over so many things. But Martha, only one thing is necessary. Only one thing is needful. Mary knew what that one thing was. Martha, don't you see that I am the way, the truth, and the life? I am the bread of life. I am the living water. I am the light of the world. I am the resurrection and the life. Martha, I'm not here to show you how to gain truth. I am truth. I'm not here to show you the way. I am the way. I'm not here to lead you to living water. I am the living water. Martha, I'm the important thing here. Not things. If we could only come to see what Mary saw. We spend so much of our time with him asking for things, good things, Christian graces, understanding, patience, courage, peacefulness. I sometimes act in my own life as if God is some master pharmacist dispensing patience to me when I'm impatient, peace to me when I'm weary, understanding to me when I am confused. He is not. God does not give us patience. He gives us his son. He does not give us understanding. He gives us his son. He does not give us courage. He gives us his son. His son becomes our patience, our understanding, our courage, our very life. And Mary understood this one thing that is necessary. But what about this day? What was the Lord's reaction this day? Listen to his words. Leave her alone. She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will have with you always, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for my burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done shall also be spoken of in memory of her. Maybe the world doesn't understand. Maybe the church doesn't understand. And perhaps not even our family understands. But Christ understood. Listen again to these words. Wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, for all of eternity, what Mary has done will be told. Why did he place so much emphasis upon this act of Mary's? Because what Mary did here is what the gospel is meant to produce in every follower of Christ. To fall in love with the Son. To waste ourselves upon him. It is the first and most important thing that God requires of us. Everything else is secondary. Service, giving, Christian graces. Martha, only one thing is necessary. How did Mary get to this point? Only one way. Brokenness. Perhaps the grief of her brother's death, the witness of his being raised by Christ. Perhaps she had received forgiveness for some overpowering sin, and out of a sense of gratitude for this newfound peace, could do nothing else but fall at his feet. The significance of that broken alabaster box was that upon breaking, it released a fragrance that filled that house. When you come into contact with that person who has been broken, really broken, so that they no longer trust themselves for anything, but Christ for everything, a person who is just willing to place themselves at the feet of Christ, the fragrance of that life will touch you in a way that nothing else can. It spreads, it fills, it changes people around them. I can't help but think that old boisterous, boastful, pride-filled Peter, "Lord, I'll be with you. I'll stand with you, Lord. I'll never deny you." After having suffered the brokenness of grief over denying Christ in that courtyard, and later, when they had been out all night fishing and they're coming ashore and John recognizes the man on the beach as the risen Christ, old Peter, he can't wait. He jumps in the water and wades ashore and falls at the feet of the Master. Our English language can't sufficiently record that conversation because we only have one word for love. The Greek language has three words: eros for physical love, filial for brotherly love, and agape for godly, unconditional love. Listen to Christ and Peter as it is recorded in the gospel. In the Greek, "Peter, do you love me?" Agape. Peter's response, "Lord, you know I love you." Filial, like a brother. This wasn't the boastful, pride-filled Peter anymore. Second time, "Peter, do you love me?" Agape. Peter's response, "Lord, you know I love you." Filial, like a brother. Third time, "Peter, do you love me?" Filial. Peter's heart must have jumped within him for the forgiveness in that word from Christ. Peter's response, filled with love now, "Lord, you know I love you." Filial, like a brother. The Lord didn't demand of Peter that he have this great agape love to be satisfactory in his sight. And Peter understood that now. He could be real. He didn't have to be fake anymore. He was forgiven. And I got to think in my heart of hearts that in that moment, on that beach, Peter's mind went back to that little room in Simon's house when he saw Mary waste her most precious possession upon the Lord. And hear the Lord say to Martha, "Martha, only one thing is needed. Only one thing. Now Peter got it. He understood. And Pastor Steve, this is what I love about you. For as long as I have known Steve, his brokenness has shown through in his humility, his love, and his caring for his people. He has lavishly poured himself out on the Christ he loves and all the people that you have touched over all the years have been blessed by it. Stephen, if anyone understands the one thing that is needful, it is you and Sue, because you guys have given your whole life to Christ and to your people. And Joe and I are blessed to call you our friend and to celebrate this wonderful occasion with you. God love you.